Welcome to Brains Matter, a podcast on science, curiosities, and general knowledge. I'm your host, Just an Ordinary Guy. Welcome, everybody, to Brains Matter. On today's episode, I interviewed Dr. Andrew Prentice from Monash University on an alternative theory of planet formation. This will be the first in a three-part series, so please make sure you listen out to the other episodes. Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to another episode of Brains Matter. On today's show, I speak to Dr. Andrew Prentice. Andrew is an astrophysicist from Monash University, and his name is probably familiar to those who are interested in planetary formation. If you have a look up Wikipedia, there's an entry for him there, and it actually says that in 1977, Dr. Prentice hypothesized that a rocky moon belt extended at 4 planetary radii from Jupiter, and his predictions were proven correct. He also predicted that Uranus had 2 more moons or moonlet streams that were commonly thought at the time, and later in the year he was also proven correct. And in 1981, Dr. Prentice predicted that the mass of Saturn's moon Tethys was actually 20 to 25% larger than was currently thought at the time, and is later proved correct. So he's got a long history of predictions that have proven true. I join Andrew in his office today, so thank you for joining me on the show.
Thank you very much, and I believe you're a former student of this university, Monash, and in fact even attended some of my classes.
Yes, I had you for second year mathematics.
You poor fellow. I hope you've fully recovered now from the experience.
I have indeed. So for those who aren't familiar with yourself, Dr. Prentice, could you give us a bit about your background?
Right. The story is the following. I've been at Monash University since for about actually 37 years. I arrived in 1972. I think it was about the time of the launch of various probes, the Pioneer probes that finished up going way out beyond Jupiter and Saturn, and then 2 years later the Mariner missions to Mercury. I was very lucky that my career more or less coincided with the start of this NASA program of planetary exploration. And throughout the last 37 years, that's sort of been the driving force behind my interest in the solar system, the discoveries that we've been made. And parallel with the discoveries being made by NASA, I've also been trying to develop my own theory, as you alluded to earlier, about how the solar system was formed. And this has become known as what I call the modern Laplacian theory. Its origins stem to a hypothesis advanced over 200 years ago by a French mathematician and astronomer called Pierre Laplace. And in 1796, he proposed in just a few lines in a book, there really wasn't any maths to go with it, and certainly no computers, that in the beginning the Sun had been this great sort of spinning globe of gas and much larger than the orbit of Neptune. And as it shrank inwards, it proceeded to spin more rapidly on its axis, like a sort of an ice skater drawing her arms to her side. And he conjectured that this great spinning globe would have spun off a ring of gas at its equator, and actually then Neptune, or more accurately Uranus, because Neptune wasn't discovered till 1846, 50 years exactly after Laplace's theory, but Laplace's theory was advanced by the excitement of the discovery of the planet Uranus. So he proposed that each planet formed from a ring of gas, and as the cloud shed its first ring, it contracted in a little further and contracted in, and it shed off another gas ring, and one by one all these individual gas rings were cast off. And then he conjectured that each of the planets of the solar system then later on condensed from these gases and gas rings as solids, and the little solid grains settled out of each gas ring onto its central or mean orbit and drew together to form the planet, or actually the core of the planet. And so each planet has got its own story to tell. Each planet, like the Earth and the interior planets of that, Venus and Mercury, and you go out further to Mars, each look entirely different. Their chemistry is completely different. They have different masses. And this individual marked differences between the planets can be explained if each planet formed, where we see it today, under different sort of thermal circumstances. And with the gas ring theory, each gas ring has its own temperature. The temperatures increase as you go towards the sun. And so Mercury forms an extremely high temperature and is predominantly known as the iron planet. It's something like 70% of iron and very little rock. And you get out to Venus, it's more like only 32% iron, and similar to the Earth. Venus is very dry, and Earth is the first planet with water, and Mars has actually probably got more water per unit mass than the Earth. But the poor planet's so small, it's only a tenth of the Earth, it's never been able to enjoy what we call plate tectonics and internal movement to bring the water to the surface. So it's in there, and only what has been at the surface and long since evaporated is a telltale sign of that beginning. So the extraordinary thing about this gas ring model, it has the most fierce critics of my theory, and I can assure you there are many of those blighters out there. They all grudgingly admit that Prentice somehow he's able to conjure up these predictions, as you mentioned earlier, and a lot of them have turned out to be right, and they more so than should have happened through chance. They grudgingly admit there's something going on that Prentice knows about. The model seems to be a valuable working hypothesis. They're not willing to put a rubber stamp on it as a legitimate theory. But the important thing is, despite all of the doings of these foul fiends, I have over the years been successful in developing the theory.
So we mentioned supersonic turbulence before. Can you explain to the listeners what supersonic turbulence is and how, after you've explained it, how this relates to planetary formation?
Sure. Well, the story here, Pratap, is that, as I had mentioned earlier about Laplace and the gas rings, that's all very well. But one problem is Laplace never told us how gas rings would form. Nowadays, the American community believes the sun did collapse, and it probably shed a great disk of gas, and this gas settled to form condensed to form a great plane of solids, there's no indication in this great gramophone record of solids that surrounded the sun exactly where the planets should form. And moreover, even if there were parts of it that did form, each planet would draw material over a very large distance. You wouldn't have the zonations that occur with the gas ring theory.
Mm-hmm. And now I guess that's the question I have. If there's a flat disk versus the zoning that you're talking about, does mathematics predict at what radii these particular zones would be?
Yes. With the mathematics, what we do is first we look at the observations, and we see, as Titius of Wittenberg and later Bode, who swiped his materials and published it under his own name, it was called Bode's Law, but it's correctly known as the Titius-Bode Law. He noted that the distances of the planets from the sun aren't just higgly-piggly, but they do form a well-defined mathematical sequence, a sequence known roughly as a geometric sequence, that one planet's distance, as the planets go out, the distance from one planet to the next roughly increases by a factor of 2. It's not quite 2, I think it's about 1.7. So the distances of the planets from the sun form this sort of rough geometric sequence. And that's the nice thing about the gas ring theory, is this great cloud contracts inwards, and if it contracts in uniformly, conserving its internal structure, the rings of gas are actually shed behind, and the ratio of one orbit to the next is related to the mass of the gas ring over the cloud. And if that's preserved, this ratio of one orbit to the next is a constant, and that's what's known as a geometric sequence. And right back as far as about 1972, and I mentioned I first arrived at this university, I published my first paper about that and pointed out how the supersonic turbulence leads to this formation of the gas rings, which have the geometric sequence. But what is supersonic turbulence? The supersonic turbulence is that mechanism that takes place within the cloud, and as the big cloud collapses, The supersonic turbulence causes the cloud to shed its excess spin angular momentum, not as a disk, but as an individual little burps or individual little rings.
So, and going back to that skater analogy you used before, if the skater's spinning and she has some items of clothing or sparkles on her body, and then she goes at a certain speed that's just a little bit too fast, they fly off.
Yes, indeed. And what happens is she sheds or whatever weights or stuff so that you can stay on balance or on cue. But what happens is, as the great cloud contracts inwards more it becomes is like a ballet dancer was able to shrink in size. She'd spin even faster again. And sort of to hold that for herself flying apart, she'd have to move her arms out to slow herself down. And so what is really happening is the supersonic turbulence is actually a very powerful convection, a thermal convection within the great solar cloud, and it's driven by the huge amounts of heat within the interiors of the cloud and the heat rising plumes, just like very tragically we've seen, of course, the bushfires in Victoria. And people have reported extraordinary winds, fierce winds, fire winds. And the same thing happened with the burning of Dresden. You know, it had winds up to 200 miles an hour caused by the huge heat at the center of the fire. And nothing possibly can actually stop those winds. They're known as fire winds. Or within the primitive sun, there was this huge firestorm and great rising thermals, and they reach the top of the atmosphere, which extends right up to the top and looking out into space. And there the great cloud cools, and as it cools, you have descending columns, great columns of sinkers of very cold air that shoot down. And I have a student who modeled these, and these are called supersonically moving downdrafts of very cold gas, great fingers of gas, and they go right down to about half the depth of the cloud. And they actually cool, try to quench the heat from the interior. And Chris Deit, who worked for me, and he's now with the CSIRO out there in Western Australia, he actually, for his PhD, he actually showed that this simple conjectural idea of the firestorms will actually profoundly disturb the interior structure of the cloud. And whereas in the deep interior, the convection is very fierce, and you know, I mentioned those huge down plumes that pick up space, moving many times the speed of sound. They bang into one another and create turbulence and more heat, and the whole thing's completely chaotic. It's a bit like the first, you know, some lecture theatres that used to be at Monash before they introduced fees with engineers. I don't think you would have been in that category. In the early days, we had to fine students and throw them out for misdeeds and misbehaviour. I once remember of a volley of darts coming down with exploding tips that landed around me. And on one occasion, the whole lights grew dim in the theatre. And I said, this is unfortunate. It looks like there's a power out. But it wasn't a power out. It was a whole army, a flotilla of paper planes coming down. And they'd actually obliterated the neon lights. Anyway, so you have this huge amount of energy being released. It rises up through the cloud, drives these plumes to supersonic speeds. But as you get to the very top of the cloud, all the speeds have to go to zero. And the cloud, the only way it can evict its heat is by developing a very, very steep temperature gradient. And the temperature plunges thousands of degrees over a short distance. And as the temperature plunges, nature says, well, the pressure has to be conserved. But pressure is the product of density times temperature. So as the temperature goes down at the surface, the density goes up, and you have a very powerful density inversion produced by this very fierce firestorm in the star. And this density inversion leads to the formation of very, very dense shell of material at the surface of a non-rotating cloud. And as the great cloud shrinks and becomes a rotating cloud, the spherical shell slips down from the equators of the poles of the star to form a dense equatorial belt. And that's how this dense equatorial belt is later detached. It becomes the first gas ring that Laplace had conjectured 200 years ago. So the modern Laplacian theory, the extraordinary thing about it, the fabric of the whole theory embraces all aspects of mathematical and physical sciences, the atmospheric sciences, and then I mentioned early the chemistry. There's so many facets to the problem, and it's taken me 37 years just to come to this point, not because I've been slouching, but just there's such a huge mountain. So I've built it from the bottom up, this great sort of tower of knowledge, as it were, hopefully not the Tower of Babel. One has to very much distance oneself from this, and as I say, the chances of me ever getting recognition within my own lifetime are extremely rare, because I have just, you know, so many fierce critics out there who just deemed it all to be just tripe. And so fortunately, sitting behind it all, I have a very happy family life, and I'm a grandpa now, and I can see the larger picture, and I know how so very fortunate I am. I haven't been caught up with some of the calamities that happen to so many. The world is just full of calamities. And I think while you're young and you're strong, that you must, as you are perhaps now, you must work fiercely and do your day's labor. And make sure while the sun's shining, you know, that you reap the hay. And that's always been my policy over the years. And what I've done is also try to be honest and give recognition to the works of others who've gone before me, like Laplace and many other scientists. And so what if I have achieved anything in the recognition of supersonic turbulence, it hasn't just been entirely on my own doing, but it's been the work of, say, my mentor, Taha, at Oxford, who 40 years ago was the one who drew me into this subject. So sitting behind all this work is the idea of very powerful maelstrom of storms within the great cloud that formed the sun, and it shed these gas rings because of the very steep density inversion, which allowed the primitive cloud not to shed off little bits at a time to form a continuous disk, but it would form a great, it would leave a gas ring behind of considerable mass. The interior of the cloud would be realized that as it contracted inwards, it would have to restore pressure equilibrium to the surface. And the process of extruding new material to the surface of this great spinning cloud, as it spun and extruded material to the surface from the deep interior under conditions of uniform rotation, it would slow the cloud down. A bit like a youngster on a merry-go-round. As long as, if you know, an adult says, okay, now it's time to have an ice cream, if he tries to charge out on a spinning merry-go-round, he'll fall straight over. Mm-hmm. But the smart child will clamber his way from one rocking horse to another. And as all the children clamber to the outside to get their ice cream, the great wheel will slow down. And so this is this process of restoration of the great in density inversion at the surface of the cloud led to the slowing down of the interior, and the cloud therefore chose to give up its angular momentum through the excursion of isolated or discrete rings. And that sits behind all of this theory, and sitting behind even that again is the supersonic turbulence. And without embracing that and acknowledging its existence, the whole theory would collapse. And that is the very center of the argument against my work, the one which John Maddox in Nature used in 1989, despite my successful prediction of the moons of Neptune.
And that's the end of part one of the interview with Dr. Prentice. Make sure you're listening to part two in the next episode. Thanks for listening to the show. You can check out the Brains Matter website at www.brainsmatter.com. That's www.brainsmatter.com. And you can find all the other episodes of the show there. Just click on the podcast link on the right hand side. You can listen to the episodes from your browser by choosing Flash Player from the links and selecting whichever episode you want to hear from within the player. There's also other information on the site, such as links to articles and news, subscription details, both via iTunes and manually, and voting information. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can leave an entry on this episode's show notes on the webpage, or you can send me an email, All my contact information can be found on the site. The theme music Future is performed by Cut Copy and comes courtesy of Glenn Gertz from Modular Records. I hope you enjoyed the show. Bye for now.